You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, I'll talk to the creator of a new documentary on entering the medical field for African-American women. They've faced a lot of hurdles, but more and more are starting to get into that field. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The election's dominating the news this week. No surprise there. We'll check in now with Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, only a few days left, Rob.
Yeah, I can hear the excitement slash trepidation slash ennui in your voice there.
No, we can do this. I'm here. I'm present.
We're going to get through this. Now, people are voting already. There was some controversy over how and when we could early vote in different places in Wisconsin. What do we know about how many people are voting, have voted early as that wraps up?
Yes, so early voting has increased in the last couple of presidential election cycles, and we, today, Wisconsin broke 2012 records, so we have the most early voting that we've seen in the state. Our guys at USA Today Network Wisconsin broke down the numbers. So as of today is the last day of early voting in Wisconsin, so this does not include Friday's numbers, but as of Friday, we had more than 685,000 early ballots cast. That is up by almost 20,000 over 2012 already.
And that's a pretty decent proportion of the number of people who are predicted to vote all told, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, what is it, was it about 3 million?
3 million, they're saying,
yeah, a little over that. So, I mean, that's right, that's a chunk. Of course, this, you know, being where we are in the election cycle, you want to look and see what this might mean, what this says about what's going to happen on Tuesday. And one thing that is of note is that the county that had the biggest gains this year by a lot was Dane County, which, of course, is one of the most heavily Democratic parts of the state. So this is seen as a good sign by the Hillary Clinton campaign. In Madison in particular, there were 56% more early voter ballots returned than in 2012. And more good news, there were 10,000 new voters registered in Madison compared to 4 years ago.
But early voting numbers might be a tough tea lead to read accurately, because maybe those additional ones were people who were going to vote anyway on Election Day.
Who knows, right? Yeah,
right.
It's very hard to know. I mean, a thing to note is that Dane County also was the site of some very long lines during the April presidential primary. So, you know, people could be just deciding to vote early who were always going to vote, but they figure it's maybe a little more convenient this way.
Well, still more people will vote on Election Day itself, and in some places they're going to see this new thing from the Department of Justice, an election integrity team. What's that?
So the Wisconsin Department of Justice is going to send integrity teams around the state to look at polling places. This in itself is really not surprising. They've done this in previous elections. They'll go to Dane County and Rock County, Milwaukee County, and a handful of cities. The thing is, it comes in the context of some these sort of outlandish statements by the Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, who's asked his supporters to go to polling places in certain neighborhoods, and meaning African American neighborhoods, to monitor voting. So that's like this controversial thing and this sort of seen as over the line thing. This is something different. These are like trained professionals. The Wisconsin Department of Justice, after all, is the agency that's in charge of investigating crimes, including voting related crimes. So I think it's something that it got a little bit of attention this week, because you don't want to be seen as intimidating voters. People have a right to vote who they want, but of all possible sort of voter intimidation schemes, this integrity team is probably the thing to be worried the least about. These are actual professionals.
Talking to Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, rounding out the top news stories in Wisconsin of the week, all election related this edition. You mentioned Donald Trump. There's been a question all along, how is he going to affect candidates down ballot, particularly with Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race? We've got some of the last polling we're going to get before Tuesday. What do you make of that, Rob?
Sure, and I know you've talked about it on the show, and a lot of eyes on this race. And it essentially, so the what we know is that the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin between incumbent Republican Ron Johnson and former Senator Democrat Russ Feingold has tightened a lot. And this is, you know, the case in multiple polls has shown Johnson has made up some ground in these late weeks. And the Wisconsin State Journal had an interesting piece of analysis on the change that that Johnson has undergone. He was, like a lot of Republicans, had kind of gone through contortions about how much to be, to distance himself from Donald Trump. Most people do not think Donald Trump is likely to win Wisconsin next week. But the analysis that the State Journal looked at it is it doesn't seem to be hurting Johnson at all. Johnson is running well ahead of Trump in across the state, and especially in sort of some of the Republican strongholds in the state. And in just these last couple weeks, Johnson's really sort of noticeably pivoted to really embracing Trump. He on Tuesday he appeared at the first Trump campaign rally that Johnson has attended, even though Trump has been in Wisconsin a bunch of times. And he's sort of picked up one of the Trump catchphrases about Washington, D.C., drain the swamp, and has really hit hard the sort of outsider or non-career politician appeal. And it's, based on the polling numbers, it may be that it's helping him.
Are you seeing a lot of campaign ads in the Wausau area, Senate and president?
Oh, for sure. The presidential ads have started up, huh?
Yeah, there's been an uptick, I think, in my limited sample.
See, I wouldn't see them very much. You know, I'm a cord cutter. I wouldn't necessarily see them, but there was no way around it during the World Series.
Right.
that's like my entire sample almost.
Well, some big news this week that I don't want to miss. Wausau, you tell us, is finally getting stickers, those I voted stickers.
Thank you. Yes. Well, thank you for making time for this. This is important. Can you believe it's 2016, and for the first time ever, we in Wausau get I voted stickers. My colleague, Nora Hurdle, wrote about this, and she had a guy who had actually done political science research on this, and in fact, I voted stickers encourage voter participation. People, you know, it's a sort of network effect. If you can brag about it on social media, people say, "Oh yeah, maybe I want to get one of those stickers." The Journal Sentinel also had a really fun piece on the history of the I voted sticker, and supposedly, I have my doubts, but supposedly it was started by the Phoenix Association of Realtors back in 1985, who they claim that they were the first ever to offer I voted stickers.
Interesting. So why did it take so long? Explain Stickergate to me.
Yeah, right. So this is why I think we need a real historian on this issue, because I for one I have trouble believing that 1985 is the first example. Yeah, Wausau, I don't know what is behind the times. They said that they were trying to save a little money. This year they coughed up the sum of $100 for whatever it is, some tens of thousands of stickers. To me, if they needed the money, I would have happily bought the tickets. I think it's important.
We'll leave it there, Rob. Thanks as always.
All right, thank you.
Rob Mentzer there, USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at tax cuts implemented in Wisconsin and the impact they've had on the state's economy and on schools and other services. First, a new documentary looks at the lives of African-American women who decide to become doctors. It follows the trials and triumphs of African-American women physicians in the country. Here's a listen.
As a black woman, are there more challenges? Absolutely. It was just assumed that I was not the surgeon.
I would walk into a room and you would get, "When is the real surgeon coming to see me?"
Every stereotype, I was not supposed to make it.
I had never seen a doctor before I went to college. And you can't be what you can't see.
Some people even believe and buy into that post-racial statement. There's nothing post-racial in this country. Race matters. It's the first thing they see when people look at you.
We change history by not giving up the struggle. We still have to train another generation of young black girls. Open up these opportunities for them. Let them see the women who have accomplished so much and be inspired.
Moments from the documentary Black Women in Madison. It's part of a broader initiative called Changing the Face of Medicine, which aims to significantly increase the number of African-American women in medicine by the year 2030. Crystal Emery is the filmmaker behind the documentary. She joins us now to talk about it. Crystal, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, let's start out talking about the impact you're hoping to make with this documentary. What are you hoping the public takes away from it?
Well, the impact works on several different levels. I've made this film for young people to encourage them to think outside the box, to dream big, and then to demonstrate that dreams do come true. But I also made this for policymakers. You know, we are at a time in America, we're at a crossroad. And so we need to put into media more positive images of people of color that say not only are we capable, these are our contributions to the fabric or the quilt that we call America. And so the impact is, whether it's generational, whether it's young people, whether it's policymakers, you know, to begin to get them to change their belief system, to think differently about how they perceive the capableness of people of color, and particularly black women.
There was a case in the news not that long ago. Dr. Tamika Cross was on a flight, an airline flight. They needed a doctor. There was a health emergency. She said, hey, I'm a doctor, I can help you. And they basically ignored her, said, no, we're looking for an actual doctor. Is this a common experience for the women you talk to in this documentary, where people look at them, they see an African-American woman, and they can't see a doctor, even though they're actually a doctor?
I interviewed for the film Black Women in Medicine over 20 doctors, black women doctors, and all of them had a different version of the same story. The surgeon comes in, Dr. Velma Scantlebury. She's going to do a transplant, liver or kidney, and the patient says, when is the real doctor coming? Our doctors have been referred to as dietitians, as nurses, everything but the doctor. And it is because within the media, we don't see those images of black doctors. I mean, if you look at the statistics, you know, only 4.5% of practicing physicians are African American. African Americans represent 13% of the population. Dr. Jocelyn Elders puts it so eloquently, you can't be what you can't see. And so the problem is in twofold. The problem is that those who are outside of black culture have never seen black doctors. You don't see them in the movies. You are just starting to see them on television, on shows like Grey's Anatomy or one or two other shows. And then you have young black boys and girls who still have not even met a black doctor.
How much will it help medicine, especially outreach to African-American communities, if we had more African-American doctors, period, and African-American women doctors in particular?
You know, all statistics show, studies show, that patients are much more likely to respond to someone who has a similar cultural background. And so, you know, we need more doctors. You know, 2050 in America, the majority of Americans will be people of color. On the other side, we just need good doctors. I mean, it doesn't matter what your race is. We need good doctors. But then when you bring a woman into the equation, you know, women are just a little bit more sensitive to the whole person versus just the disease. And women are the healers. I mean, you know, when you fall as a kid and you injure yourself, you don't usually call dad first. You call mom because there is a maternal instinct there. And so as our country is in great need of a healing, changing the face of medicine is part of that healing.
We're talking to Crystal Emery about her new documentary, Black Women in Medicine. One thing I love about the documentary, Crystal, is you cover a whole lot of generations. And I want to start, you talked to some of the first African-American women in different medical fields. What kind of things did you hear from them?
You know, I had the wonderful opportunity to actually stay at the home of Dr. Jocelyn Elders in Little Rock, Arkansas. And one of the things that I love about her is that she does not allow race, gender, economics to hold her back. And so in interviewing her over a two-year period, it was the consistent, do not focus on the negative, keep focused on what your objective is and the positive. And I think that a lot of our young people, Rob, regardless of what your background is, a lot of our young people are caught up in instant gratification. And if they don't get it right now, it's the end of the world. And what I learned and what I hope that anyone experiencing Black Women in Medicine understands that perseverance and determination does pay off. And I think for the older doctors, that was a theme that constantly was repeated.
I look at medical school, and I think that looks really challenging. Even I, as a white male, think that. I don't think I could persevere through that. How many extra hurdles are there for Black women trying to go through this already very challenging program of medical school?
Well, you know what, Rob? The good thing about medical school is everybody should not be a doctor.
I'm on that list, yeah.
Yeah, and so am I. You know, I remember when I shot Dr. Jennifer Ellis in Washington, D.C., doing open heart surgery. I did not stay for all of that filming. When they cut the body, I was like, oh, I'm out of here. I think that, you know, it is so challenging, medical school in general, but it is also a culture of privilege. And so you don't wake up at 18 and decide, oh, today I'm going to go to medical school. A lot of the white American potential medical students, parents started very early in grooming them with the sciences and also the culture of medicine. And so when you are a African American, male or female, and you are now finished undergrad and you're entering this very exclusive, because it's an exclusive club, there are situations, and I think that Dr. Karen Priester Morris says it so great in the film, where her fellow student would say, oh, come on, let's do this, and we'll just put it on our credit card. Well, she didn't have a credit card. Or when her electricity got cut off, she did not have someone to say, my electricity is cut off, I won't get paid for a week, I need help. Because it did not lend itself within that environment, because it is an environment of privilege. You also have the issues of race. You know, there are still many that enter the medical school that have not had any interaction with people of color. And I say people of color because I don't mean just Black Americans, but Hispanic Americans or Native Americans, and they come with a set of preconceived ideas. And so you're constantly working against someone else's preconceived notion of who you should be. And, you know, within medical school, you have to make friends, bond, and have a camaraderie, because these are the same people that are going to be sending you services. You know, they're going to be recommending their clients to come to your practice. And so when you are a young person, a young Black person, and particularly if you are in a predominantly white medical school, you know, you get very lonesome. And not just lonesome for a good meal, but lonesome for that face that says, I support you, I'm here, I have your back.
And you shared not just the challenges, you got to be there for some really inspiring moments, and you opened the documentary with when some of the doctors find out where they're going to get their residency, and they're opening that envelope, and it's, for some of them anyway, a moment of pure joy.
You know, it's called Match Day. And Match Day happens all around the country and sort of simultaneously. The envelopes are sealed and they let them in the room, and it's like a cattle herd, you know, rushing in. And then it's, you know, screams of joy, you know, families, you know, everybody's excited. But if you look around, there's that one person over there that did not get the match that they wanted, you know, that will have to go to some remote area that they never, ever thought they would have to go to. In my case, the women that I had chosen, they just ended up to be such exceptional personalities. And so watching them jump for joy, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot.
Well, Crystal, thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Thank you.
That was Crystal Emery. She's a filmmaker. Her newest work is a documentary called Black Women in Medicine, which recently premiered on American Public Television. We'll get some info about that documentary on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, Governor Walker and the Wisconsin legislature have made significant tax cuts in an effort to boost the state's economy. We'll talk about how those cuts have impacted Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, news broke earlier this week that a Saudi Arabian student was killed at UW-Stout this weekend, sparking fears in the community that the crime might be racially motivated. We'll discuss the impact his death is having on the campus. First, tax cuts have been a point of pride for Governor Walker since he took office more than 5 years ago. In May of this year, the Department of Revenue estimated that nearly $424 million had been returned to Wisconsin taxpayers by income tax cuts alone. But while these cuts returned money to residents, that meant there was less money for state services, like public education. How did these tax cuts impact the state? How does Wisconsin compare to other states which implemented similar tax policies? Joining us now to answer these questions is Simon Montlake. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. His piece, How Tax Cuts Changed Wisconsin, was published this week. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, set things up for us at first. Talk about when these tax cuts came into effect. What was the case made for them? How extensive were they?
Well, when Governor Walker took office in 2010, of course, it was during the Great Recession. And so clearly there was big challenges to the budget in Wisconsin and in many states. Revenues were down. Tax take was down. Growth had faltered. So there was a what they call a structural deficit, meaning that, you know, the money that agencies needed in the state budget was always going to be more than was coming in. So Governor Walker made very clear as he campaigned that he was going to cut taxes and keep them as low as possible. So there were modest tax cuts in the first budget. It was more the pressure was more on controlling spending. The second budget was from 2013 to 2015. There was much more tax cuts in that budget. And now this was both on, you know, individuals, income tax. It was keeping down property taxes, and crucially, it was on companies. There was a new credit available for manufacturing and agriculture, which essentially zeroed out their tax rate. And in addition to that, there's some other sort of incentive programs for investment, which would, again, provide tax credits to companies. So, I mean, there were billions of dollars in tax cuts, and some of this has continued now. Of course, some of these stay in place. But there isn't really much room to cut much more at the moment. So I think what we've seen is a persistent attempt to keep taxes as low as possible, particularly on companies and on higher earning individuals. And so really we're several years into this now, and so I think it's fair to say, show me the results to look at what this tax-cutting policy has achieved.
Right, and as I understand it, the political and economic case made here is cut taxes, leave more money in the hands of both individuals and, as you mentioned, companies. They're going to spend, they're going to invest, they're going to hire more people. That's going to help the economy, which in turn will help the state budget. More economic activity ultimately means more revenue. So in this piece, you're trying to set out to measure that. What kind of things did you try to sort out?
Well, yeah, I mean, the case you laid out is known as supply-side economics. I mean, if you go back to the 1980s, it became the sort of Reagan-era orthodoxy. It began in the 70s as a slightly obscure economic theory. And, the basic idea was, as you just laid it out, that by cutting taxes particularly on job creators, on the wealthy, on companies, that would then, produce the economic growth that rewards you. I mean, the idea, though, that it would produce the same revenues is a very controversial one. I mean, if you look at the evidence, it doesn't really hold up. The fact is, if you cut taxes, you can probably argue that it will produce some growth. However, you're going to collect less revenue in your budget. And most economists say this is just the way it is. It's not going to pay for itself in the medium term, talking, say, 5 to 7 years. Now, you could argue that doesn't matter because, the growth itself is the goal. But, I mean, you have to be very careful of people that sort of think you can, have your cake and eat it, that you can both, cut taxes, get growth, and get the same amount of revenue coming in. Because without the revenue coming in, then something has to give, and what has to give usually is public spending. The way I looked at it in Wisconsin was fairly simple. It was just looking at the budgets, how much revenue came in, how the growth did, how the governor did on job creation, which again was one of his priorities. And, I'm not trying to say that it's a disaster by any means. I mean, Wisconsin's economy has clearly come back quite strongly in some ways. On the other hand, so has the United States. So, you have to look at it and say, is this really outperforming? Is this tracking what other similar states with similar industries have? And I think, in some respects, Wisconsin's done a bit better in the last year or so. If you look at the 2015 data. But if you go back to, the recession and since the recession, I don't think you could argue that its recovery has been spectacular, and it certainly hasn't outperformed in the way that these, the tax-cutting proponents would argue. And there are some reasons for that. I mean, it's hard. The reality is that what drives the economy doesn't change that radically. If you're in a state which has a lot of oil and gas, the oil and gas price goes up, you have some good years, and when that crashes, there's not much you can do. It doesn't really matter what your tax rate is. You're going to have less growth, less jobs, less revenue. If you are in New York and you have financial services, when those do very well, you're going to have more tax revenue. You're going to have more jobs. I mean, Wisconsin is, as of course you know, I mean, agriculture and manufacturing is still very strong, but then again, so is services. So that's what you have to work with. That is the existing mix of economic factors. I do think tax cuts can be useful. They can achieve goals. There's no doubt about it. And clearly, if taxes are too high, that has the opposite effect. That can hold back economic growth. But you still have to ask the question, is cutting taxes to the level that Wisconsin has done, which means less revenue for the government to spend on public services, is that ultimately the right way to chart an economic course over many years ahead? Because these are long-term forces at play.
We're talking to Simon Montlake, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, looking at the impact of tax cuts here in Wisconsin. And Simon, in your piece, you actually went and talked to two different groups. You talked, first of all, to some employers. What did you hear from the employers you talked to about whether the changing tax situation in Wisconsin had affected what they were doing?
Well, they are positive on that. They Governor Walker is seen as someone who's very receptive to what business leaders are looking for. They want their state to be seen nationally and globally as an attractive place to invest, and taxes do feed into that. So there's positive news there. However, you have to remember, if you're talking about multinationals and where they locate their facilities, where they choose to invest, you know, in many cases, I mean, the state tax rate is just not a big calculation. They're looking at available land. They're looking at the broader regulatory framework. They need to know if there's going to be enough of a workforce there. Will there be a pipeline of young people, the people with the right skills, the right education? I think that infrastructure and education seem to weigh, I mean, if you look at surveys of people working with relocation industries and site selectors, I mean, they put a great weight on those things. I'm not sure that the state income tax or corporate tax rate really weighs that heavily. Now, that said, some of the companies I spoke to could point to very specific investments that they had made in which the lower tax rates and tax incentives made a difference. Now, you know, they're investing money, private money, in facilities, factories, warehouses, delivery sites, and they're hiring more people, and in turn, they will then, you know, consume more local goods, helps the real estate market. I mean, there is a virtuous cycle going on there. So I wanted to make sure that was shown in my story. But again, you always have to weigh it against what is happening in terms of the government budget.
And yeah, I want to jump in and get to some other groups you talked to. You focused in on a suburban, education advocacy group in the Milwaukee area, in Wauwatosa in particular. What kind of things were you hearing there about the impact of state budget changes, budget cuts to education?
Well, I mean, in some ways, this is a fairly affluent, successful district. I mean, this is not, they are not, I don't want to say that they are the suffering types. I mean, they have got a good local school system that they're trying to defend. And I think what they saw is that when the state did not have the revenues perhaps that it hoped for from its economic pump priming, what it tried to do, what Governor Walter proposed doing in his last budget, was cutting money from K-12 education. I mean, K-12 education is a very complicated area in terms of, you know, funding from the local taxes, state taxes, the federal money. It's a very, you know, the complicated formula for how much schools get. So it wasn't the case that they were seeing massive cuts coming, but they were expecting that they would lose some services, perhaps lose a teacher or two. And it just seemed to them to be a trend that there was sort of a cutting away at something which they, and I guess many people are proud of in Wisconsin, which is a strong a public education system, a great university system. People are very proud of this and want to protect it. And there was, I was interested in just understanding these, you know, fairly, middle class, upper middle class people, and what really had got their goat. Why they'd sort of formed a group and gone into public advocacy on this issue. And I also found from talking to people working in rural school areas and I went out to another rural school area as well, didn't make it into the story. They're facing, you know, even more pressure, in fact, on budget, the difficulty of retaining teachers. I mean, this, in some ways, this gets onto Act 10, which is, you know, a whole topic in itself. And this is not a story about Act 10. But I do think that schools is probably the area where you have both, you know, it's the biggest part of the government budget. So it's the easiest place to make cuts from. But it's also a very large constituency of people who feel very passionately about public education. And at the same time, you do have this, voucher choice movement, which the Republican Party and legislature and the governor is very supportive of. And they have siphoned more and more money, which is for public education, into that sector, which essentially goes into private institutions. So there is some tension around that as well. And I did, you know, use that in my story. But I think the key question here is, you know, If education is such an important driver of an economy, of a modern economy, because we're not going back, we're going forward, and it's only going to be that case, you know, what is the downside risk to a state like Wisconsin from chipping away at the money it spends on public schools educating the workforce of tomorrow?
We'll leave it there. Simon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice talking with you.
Simon Montlake is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He recently wrote a piece called How Tax Cuts Changed Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Ken and his guests look at the impact of early voting, last-minute political surprises, and the congressional races to watch around the nation. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, this weekend, 24-year-old UW Stout student Hussein Saeed Al-Nadi was assaulted by an unknown attacker in the early Sunday morning hours. He died on Monday. The killing has shaken up the campus, and Menominee police have yet to find the suspect or determine a motive. However, as violence against Muslims has reached a high point since 9/11, people are questioning whether or not the attack on the Saudi Arabian student was a hate crime. That's something the police investigating have not confirmed or ruled out. Joining us now to talk about the news is Karen Herzog. She's higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been covering this news in Menominee. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, the latest news we'll start with, you reported just a little while ago, the FBI is now involved in this investigation.
That's correct, and it's really difficult to say exactly what that means, but I think it's fair to say that the aspect of whether it could potentially be a hate crime is why the Menominee Police Department consulted with the FBI. It's also been a challenging case because they've gotten a lot of tips, but they obviously haven't been able to solve this crime. They haven't been able to arrest anyone, and it's been almost a week now. So they've added resources, including the FBI, the Sheriff's Department, and, of course, the UW Stout Police Department also is involved.
Tell us a little bit about the UW Stout student, Hussein Al-Nadi. What do we know about him?
He was very well liked, and last night at the memorial service for him, it was moving to see a row of friends. There were 20 friends, and they took turns talking about him. And these were largely students from Wisconsin, kids who grew up in communities and never probably encountered a person from another country, from especially Saudi Arabia, in their lives. He was very well liked. He wanted to be part of the American community. He barely spoke English when he moved into a house with a bunch of kids from Wisconsin, and they loved being with him. He had an easy smile. He worked hard to learn, and he was just gregarious and attracted people to him, very charismatic.
Tell us more about that memorial service last night that you covered.
It's hard to put into words. The only word I could think of last night was that it was beautiful. It was very moving. It was something that brought a community together in a way that unfortunately sometimes only happens when there's a tragedy. And the friends speaking, the candlelight vigil. There was Al-Nadi's brother spoke as well. From a big screen, they had a pre-recorded video of him in traditional dress, Arabic dress, and he talked about how much his brother loved all of his friends at UW Stout and being a part of the community, and he was just very happy here, and they have received the outpouring of support. They know that it's happening, even though they're halfway around the world, and they look forward to justice being brought against the person that attacked him.
Karen Herzog is with us. She's with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering the murder of a Saudi Arabian student at UW Stout, Hussein Saeed Al-Nadi. He was not the only Saudi Arabian student there. Karen, how many Saudi Arabian students are there on that campus, and how have they been reacting to this news?
Well, understandably, there's deep shock and sadness. It's something that, you know, you don't expect to happen anywhere, but Menominee is a place that has really been very welcoming of students from Saudi Arabia. There are 142 students from Saudi Arabia on the campus of about 9,600. It's the largest group of international students there, and that all started with an agreement with a junior college in Saudi Arabia years ago that brought several students here. And then word of mouth spread, and this became a place that people wanted to come to. Understandably, parents in Saudi Arabia have been very worried about their kids here being so far away, not knowing exactly what's going on, and the fact that there is still a person out there who committed a crime, and they don't know who he is, what his thinking is, and what could happen next.
And again, reemphasizing that the motive behind this attack, we don't know yet. But is there concern, is there worry on the campus that this was a hate crime?
You know, they can't rule it out. And it's one of those things where I think people obviously jump to conclusions. It's very little information is known. Very little information has been revealed by authorities. They're very careful to guard it, to not put anything out there that could in any way cause problems for the investigation. There is a reward fund set up for information that could lead to the arrest of this individual. So they're part of the work with the reward fund is making sure that, you know, there's information that's not out in the public so that when they get tips, they know whether the person knows something authentically or whether they read it.
From what you've written about the reaction from the campus officials, students, you mentioned friends, it seems like regardless of the motive, there's been a really conscious effort to stand behind Saudi Arabian students and the community on the campus.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a makeshift memorial that was set up outside the Toppers restaurant where the attack occurred. And that memorial was being taken down today. And the restaurant obviously wanted to put things back to normal as much as that is even possible at this point. But the campus is going to preserve that memorial. And basically it's flowers, candles, notes, pictures. It's really quite beautiful, quite moving. And they're going to try to create something that's a permanent reminder. So the hope is to prevent something like this from happening again.
This case, obviously, very powerfully affecting the local community, but it seems like it's getting national and even international attention. Are you seeing a lot of reporting from national and other outlets on this?
Yes, social media has very much spread this story quickly to Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of alumni from UW Stout who live in Saudi Arabia, and I have actually seen a lot of Twitter activity from Saudi Arabia, things that have been retweeted in Arabic. My understanding is that there is a lot of concern and a lot of interest in seeing that that this case is solved as soon as possible.
And then the reaction from UW Stout itself and the administration, as someone who covers higher education a lot, what have you seen from officials there?
It's one of those things that chancellors hope they never have to deal with, but unfortunately, it's an important role that they play in providing support, first of all, you know, to the students who are involved and also the family. From afar, there's a Saudi student who's the liaison for the campus with the family in Saudi Arabia, and they've been really trying to reach out to see what the family needs. Counseling, there was a lot of talk about counseling services and how to grieve in a healthy way and to not isolate oneself. So it's a big process of coming to grips with what's happened and also trying to learn some lessons about different cultures and the value of bringing everyone together, especially in a university community.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joins to talk about the killing of UW Stout student Hussein Saeed Al-Nahdi this weekend, the effect the attack is having on the campus. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.